Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
This is part two of the Mike Williams solved case. If you haven't already listened to part one, we highly recommend you go back now to catch up on the details leading up to this point.
To briefly recap, on December 16th, 2000, Denise, Mike's wife, became worried when Mike didn't return home from a solo duck hunting trip at Lake Seminole. As evening approached, her concern grew, and she reported him missing to the authorities and called friends and family to alert them. A search was quickly organized, and soon they discovered Mike's empty boat drifting aimlessly on the lake. The initial discovery sent shockwaves through the community and triggered an extensive search effort.
Search teams scoured the lake and surrounding areas, hoping to find any sign of Mike, a piece of clothing, his hunting gear, or tragically, his body. They deployed boats, divers, and helicopters, but despite their exhaustive efforts, there was no sign of Mike. As the search efforts dragged on, the lake's stillness seemed almost mocking, refusing to give up its secrets. For many, the explanation seemed simple: an unfortunate accident. Mike had fallen off his boat, and the weight of his water-filled waders made it impossible for him to resurface. Alligators prevalent in this lake had likely scavenged what was left, leaving no trace behind.
But for Cheryl Williams, Mike's mom, none of this felt right. The explanation offered little comfort to a mother's intuition. Something in her heart told her things were not as they seemed, nor was her son in that lake. While others accepted the grim narrative, Cheryl held fast to her faith and the subtle whispers she felt in her soul, a quiet yet undeniable feeling that her son's story was far from over. And it wasn't just intuition that nagged at Cheryl. Alligators rarely hunt or eat during the winter, especially on cold nights like the one that Mike disappeared on. Even then, it's unusual for alligators to consume a full body without leaving any trace behind. And there was something else gnawing at her. Hadn't her son told her he wasn't going hunting alone that morning?
As Cheryl continued to search for her son, Denise Williams was taking a far more pragmatic approach. Just days after Mike went missing, Kansas City Life Insurance Company received a notice of his presumed death. Mike held two life insurance policies with the company, totaling $1.25 million. Unsurprisingly, Denise was listed as the sole beneficiary. What stood out even more was the person who had sold Mike those policies. It was his best friend, Brian Winchester. To add another layer of complexity, it was Brian's father, Marcus Winchester, who formally notified the insurance company of Mike's death. While progress on the life insurance claim began swiftly, every other aspect of the investigation into Mike's disappearance remained frustratingly stagnant.
February 2001, more than 2 months after Mike Williams went missing on Lake Seminole, the search for him, dead or alive, was officially called off. During this time, Denise Williams, Mike's wife, became the focus of the community's sympathy. Among her strongest supporters were Mike's boss and mentor, Clay Ketchum, and his wife, Patty. In a small town like theirs, neighbors rally around their own in times of tragedy. While Denise publicly mourned her missing husband, Clay and Patty discreetly ensured that Mike's paycheck continued to be deposited into Denise's account. Mike had been a high earner, and the income was enough to keep Denise financially afloat for the time being. Privately, Denise confided in close friends and family about her growing concern over her financial future. What they didn't know was that Mike's boss had been ensuring Denise continued to receive Mike's paychecks. With no knowledge of the support, her friends saw nothing amiss when she began selling Mike's possessions to make ends meet. Denise also shared with them her fears of financial devastation if she couldn't access Mike's life insurance policy. Despite the slim-to-none chance that Mike was still alive, he was officially classified a missing person, which legally prevented her from claiming the policy immediately.
Under Florida law, a missing person cannot be declared legally dead until 5 years have passed since their disappearance. However, there is an exception. A presumptive death certificate can be issued if one can convince the court that the missing person likely suffered a specific peril resulting in their death. Denise quickly began to explore this option, knowing it was the key to securing her and Ainsley's financial stability. And the soft-spoken, demure, pious Denise was fragile. She leaned on those around her, and Mike's friends and family were not going to let him down. They covered all the bases for the grieving, seemed-to-be widow, and nobody did that better than Mike's best friend, Brian Winchester. As Denise sought to secure the presumptive death certificate, fate intervened with unexpected discoveries, accelerating the process for Denise. On June 21st, a fisherman discovered Mike's waders floating in the lake. 2 days later, divers were brought in and discovered more: a hunting jacket and a flashlight. In one of the pockets of the jacket was a fishing license that belonged to Mike Williams.
June 29, 2001. A court petition was filed in the Leon County Circuit Court's Probate Division. The document says the petitioner, Denise Merrill Williams, the surviving spouse of Jerry Michael Williams, presumed to be dead. The petition cited the details of the day Mike went missing, the search efforts, the agencies involved, and the recent discovery of the waders, hunting jacket, and flashlight as further evidence that Mike had drowned and been eaten by alligators. Denise also added that their marriage was that of a loving and caring relationship. It also includes their plans for the future together as a family, painting the picture of a perfect marriage. It ends with Denise requesting as the petitioner that the court enter an order presuming the death of Jerry Michael Williams. That same day, a judge signed a death certificate stating that Mike's death was an accidental drowning while duck hunting on Lake Seminole. Body has yet been recovered. Mike's mother, Cheryl, was not present at the hearing and had no idea her son was just legally declared dead. With the case closed, Denise Williams began to move on with her life. She collected substantial life insurance payouts, 2 policies from Kansas City Life, and to add to her financial windfall, she also collected an additional $500,000 from another life insurance company, one that few people knew about. The sizable sum, nearly $2 million in total, provided financial security, but it also raised eyebrows and fueled further speculation.
As Denise started to rebuild her life, there was one person who couldn't let go of the unsettling details surrounding Mike's disappearance: his mother, Cheryl Williams. Cheryl was a pillar of strength and resolve, refusing to accept the official ruling of accidental drowning. She believed there was more to the story and was determined to uncover the truth.
Cheryl's relentless pursuit for justice became her life's mission. She tirelessly campaigned for the case to be reopened, reaching out to anyone who would listen and using every resource at her disposal. Her unwavering dedication caught the attention of the media and the community, sparking renewed interest in Mike's mysterious disappearance. Cheryl's pursuit infuriated Denise, and their relationship became strained, and soon Denise forbid Cheryl and Mike's brother Nick from seeing the only part of Mike they had left, Ainsley.
Meanwhile, life was moving on. Brian and Kathy eventually got divorced, and Denise was there for Brian, like really there. Friends and family observed how the two quickly seemed inseparable. Often seen together at social events and community gatherings, their chemistry was undeniable. The gossip and suspicion grew as the two began openly displaying their affection. Eventually, Denise and Brian made their relationship official by getting married in December of 2005. To many, it seemed more than coincidental, casting a dark shadow over what should have been a joyous new beginning for the couple.
Here's Steve Epstein, an attorney and best-selling true crime author who met Cheryl while writing a book about Mike's case. His book is called Evil at Lake Seminole.
Brian moved into the former house, the house that Mike raised enough money to buy, lived in the same bedroom that Mike lived in, became dad to Ainsley. He basically took over Mike's role in everybody's life. And the working theory was there's a lot of what's called hydrilla, which are grassy plants that grow from the bottom of the lake. They got tangled up in a boating accident, couldn't free himself, and then his body was eaten by alligators.
Despite the passage of time, Cheryl refused to concede. The marriage between Brian and Denise only fueled her passion to uncover the truth, and she began standing outside Brian and Denise's neighborhood and church with signs displaying her son's face on a missing persons poster. She knew in her heart that Mike's death was no accident, and she wouldn't rest until she had the answer she so desperately sought. Cheryl's efforts highlighted the glaring inconsistencies and cast a spotlight on the potential motives lurking beneath the surface.
Cheryl's fight for justice was anything but easy. Her unshakable spirit kept the case alive. Her determination not only brought attention to the unresolved questions surrounding Mike's disappearance, but also underscored a mother's unwavering love and lengths she would go to seek the truth for her son. As the layers of deception slowly began to peel away, it became clear that the story of Mike Williams was far from over, and Cheryl Williams wasn't about to give up until she found the answers her son deserved.
By 2012, the seemingly perfect life Denise and Brian had built together was starting to fall apart. Their 7-year marriage, which had started under a cloud of speculation, was now plagued by affairs and alcohol abuse that led to tension and distrust. The pair separated. Denise was seeking to sever ties with the man who had once been her confidant. She was adamant the separation was the first step towards divorce.
Brian grew up with a lot of sexual repression, it is not a well-kept secret that he had all kinds of addictions to porn, to sex, and that was eventually his undoing with Denise. It was his undoing with his whole family, in that his son, who was like 16 or 17, discovered pictures of prostitutes on his phone, disowned his father, and all this happened right before some of the critical events that eventually broke this story wide open.
But Brian wasn't ready to let go. Not of Denise, and certainly not of the secrets they shared. He knew that if their relationship dissolved, the house of cards they'd built would come crashing down. Denise's decision to divorce wasn't just a rejection of Brian. It was a threat to everything they had carefully concealed about Mike's disappearance and the dark truth behind their relationship.
In Brian's mind, Denise was more than just a scorned wife. She was a liability. He believed she could use the secrets of their past against him, potentially exposing the truth and destroying both their lives. That fear, coupled with his desperation to regain control, pushed Brian to a dangerous breaking point. It was becoming clear the marriage was beyond repair. Denise hired a lawyer and started pushing for the divorce by officially filing in 2015. Brian was shocked when he received the financial settlement proposed by her attorney. Remember, Denise entered the marriage already financially secure from the nearly $2 million of life insurance money. Brian would not be entitled to any of that money, as it was considered Denise's separate property. This was a tipping point for Brian, who felt entitled to share after everything they had done together to secure it. His resentment simmered beneath the surface, creating tension in their relationship as he struggled with the reality that Denise controlled the fortune while he was left empty-handed. From here, his life took a downward spiral that left him suicidal.
On the morning of August 5th, 2016, Denise was driving into work and approaching a stop sign. As she slowed, she caught something out of the corner of her eye. Brian, armed with a gun, emerged from behind her car and forced his way in. He held her at gunpoint, driving them to a secluded area. It was a chilling moment of reckoning. Brian's actions weren't impulsive. They were calculated. He begged, threatened, and coerced Denise, desperate to make her reconsider the divorce. He told her that they had come too far to turn back now. The secrets they shared bound them together in ways no one else could understand.
After the kidnapping, Denise didn't immediately go to the police. Fearful of what Brian might do next, she confided in her sister, whose husband was a 20-year veteran with the Tallahassee Police Department. It was his persistence that finally convinced Denise to report the terrifying ordeal. When Denise sat down with investigators, she told them about the fear that had consumed her, how Brian's actions had escalated to the point where she no longer felt safe. To the police, this was more than a kidnapping case. They saw an opportunity to see if Denise might turn on Brian and reveal what she knew about Mike Williams' death. But Denise wasn't ready to talk. Despite everything, she held her ground, refusing to implicate Brian in anything beyond what had just happened. Frustrated but determined, investigators moved forward with the charges they could prove. Brian Winchester was arrested for kidnapping, domestic assault with a deadly weapon, and armed burglary. He had hit rock bottom.
On May 4th, 2017, while Brian sat behind bars awaiting trial, his marriage to Denise officially came to an end. Their divorce was finalized, severing the last legal tie between them. But for Brian, the ordeal was far from over. With his trial looming, he began to panic, realizing the walls and the secrets were closing in. Desperation led Brian to make a series of bad decisions that only worsened his predicament. His arrogance and missteps aggravated the legal time he was already facing. But it wasn't just the charges piling up against him. It was the unrelenting resolve of the state attorney. The state wasn't interested in cutting any deals. They refused to offer Brian a plea bargain and were determined to press him for the answers they believed he was hiding. Their persistence paid off. Backed into a corner and terrified of what might come next, Brian was ready to talk.
And when he did, the revelations were shocking. Brian was about to give investigators the one thing they'd spent years searching for, the truth about what happened to Mike Williams. But the cost of his cooperation would be steep. Brian was about to strike a deal that would allow him to escape justice for one of the most chilling crimes imaginable.
In exchange for his confession, Brian was poised to get away with murder, literally. It was a bitter pill for investigators and Mike's family to swallow. But they knew the importance of finally exposing the truth. Brian's words would be the key to unlocking a case that had haunted so many for nearly two decades. As part of what is legally called a proffer agreement, Brian would only be sentenced to 20 years for the kidnapping of Denise Williams, in exchange for a full detailed confession and location of Mike's remains. Brian would be granted full immunity for any and all involvement in Mike Williams' disappearance.
For Cheryl Williams, the years of heartbreak and determination were about to culminate in a moment of clarity. Brian's confession wouldn't undo the pain, but it would finally answer the question she'd been asking for so long. After years of silence and secrecy, Brian Winchester finally cracked. Cornered by the weight of his own actions and with no other way out, he decided to talk. What you're about to hear is the moment everything changed, the moment the truth about Mike Williams's disappearance was finally revealed.
For investigators, this was the breakthrough they'd been waiting for. Brian's confession wasn't just a recounting of events. It was a window into the dark, twisted motives and chilling decisions that had shaped this case from the very beginning.
As you listen, remember, this confession wasn't given out of guilt or remorse. It was born from desperation, a calculated attempt to save himself from the consequences of his own crimes. But the weight of guilt is evident. Brian's words are haunting. They lay bare the betrayal, greed, and unimaginable cruelty at the heart of this case.
What you are about to hear is Brian's own recount. In his own voice. It's raw, it's disturbing, and it's the moment the pieces of this tragic puzzle finally fell into place.
This is Brian Winchester's confession.
From what I remember about that night before, Mike had volunteered to ring the bell for the Salvation Army at like a Walmart. And Kathy and I had planned on going out to a concert at Floyd's, and I wanted us all to go out, as I remember it, but that didn't end up happening for whatever reason. I don't know if they couldn't get a babysitter or why they didn't end up going out with us, but Kathy and I did end up going out to that concert. Part of the plan was that I wanted Kathy to basically be as drunk as possible the night before because I wanted her to sleep late the next morning. My alibi The plan was that all of this would occur very early in the morning, and I would have time enough to get back and meet my father-in-law up near I-10 and Thomasville Road to actually go on a hunting trip with him. So that was going to be my cover, going to be my alibi. Her alibi was going to be that she was at home with Ansley. And the plan was, when Mike didn't come back home, that eventually she was going to start calling her sisters and her dad from her house phone so that she could establish that she was at the house, prove that she was at the house with Ansley.
Okay. So what was the plan to make this happen? What happened?
So Kathy and I went out went to the concert. Got home late. She did have a lot to drink. There was discussion between me and Denise, and I can't remember if I actually did this or not, or if I did it the week prior, or I just really can't remember. But I remember Denise and I talking about there was some medication. There was some medication that Kathy had. And we talked about giving her a little bit of that medication that would cause her to sleep really heavy, and make sure that she slept really good through all of it, because I didn't want her to wake up and realize how early, I didn't want her to know how early I was leaving the next morning. So the plan with Mike was that I would meet him at a gas station on Thomasville Road up near the overpass. Well, the overpass I don't think was there at that point, but meet him up at a gas station up near the McDonald's up there. And I met him there. I had told him that we were going to go to a secret special spot to go hunting. And that he needed to bring his waders. I had to make sure that he brought his waders, because the belief was, there was kind of like a, there still is probably like a duck hunter's myth that if you fall overboard with your waders, you're going to sink really quick and drown. So I had to make sure that he brought his waders. And so I told him about this, you know, great spot that we were going to go, and he needed to bring his waders. So I met him at the gas station. And I told him when he drove up, I was real paranoid about phones and him calling me and there being a record of him calling me. So I told him that my battery was dead on my phone, that there was no reason for him to call me as we were driving over to the lake. Because normally we would have called and talked to each other on the phone, or even ridden together. I don't even remember how or why I told him that I needed to use my vehicle instead of just going in his. But for somehow I came up with some reason to do that.
Stop you right there real quick. You said that you called him and tried to get him to make sure he was going to get the waders. When did you call him and talk about that?
I don't remember specifically. We talked several times. You know, Mike and I talked every day ourselves. So, you know, we talked about hunting all the time. And we talked about this trip several times prior to it happening. So I followed him over to the lake. He had his boat behind his Bronco, and I followed him in my white Suburban.
What lake?
Lake Seminole, which is about 50 minutes away. And I had told him what landing we needed to go to. And so we pulled into the landing and launched the boat. And I said something. I had to make sure that he had the waders on. So I said something about, we're running low on time, or you know, we're going to be really pushed. And
why was it so important for the waders to be on?
Because I believed, and we believed, that if you fell overboard with the waders on, that you would sink pretty quickly. So I told him something like, we're running late, you know, we need to go ahead and put our waders on, you know, here and now before we get in and go. And so we both did that. And because I knew where we were going hunting, I was in the back of the boat driving, and he was in the front. So
about a boat. What kind of boat are we talking about? We're talking about like a large airboat, or what are we talking about?
It was a what's called a genoo. It's basically a canoe that has a flat back that you can put a small motor on the back of it.
I'm familiar with canoes. Canoes can be a little tipsy.
This boat,
the same way.
This boat was, yes, basically like a canoe, so pretty tippy.
Okay. So you put the boat in the water and you're heading out and you're driving?
Yes, sir. I was driving, and I know I was very concerned about the time. Everything had taken longer than what I had anticipated, and I had to be back in town early enough in time to meet my father-in-law for my alibi trip to occur. And so we headed out, and there was a deep area, maybe a couple hundred yards from the landing that we put in at. And we got to that area that I knew was a deep area. And I don't remember exactly how I got him to stand up, but I don't know if I pretended something was wrong with the motor or the weight in the boat was off or something, but I basically stopped the boat and got him to stand up. And when he did, I pushed him into the water.
What happened next?
So he was in the water, and he was like struggling, and the motor of the boat was still running, and I pulled off just a little bit to get kind of away from him so that he couldn't reach back into the boat. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know if he was trying to swim, or I didn't know what was going on, but what I came to find out, or eventually realized, was he was taking the waders and the jacket off. And he got those off, and I think I forgot to tell you about this part before, but I remember now that area of the lake had a lot of snags, a lot of dead trees that come up out of the water, and there's a lot of stumps that come up out of the water. And he swam over to one of those stumps and held on to it. And he was panicking, and I was panicking. And none of this was like going well. I thought it was going to go. And I didn't know what to do. But he started to yell. And I didn't know how to get out of that situation. And so I had my gun in the boat. And so I loaded my gun, and I made one or two circles around, and I ended up circling closer towards him, and he was in the water, and as I passed by, I shot him. Head. So when I shot him, it was dark, and there was a bright flash when that happened, And I didn't want to see what happened. So, like, I closed my eyes when the instant of that flash happened. And the boat was moving as this happened. And so I turned back around and came back to where he was. And got to the stump. And I knew I couldn't leave him there being shot. So I was going to have to do something to cover this up. And I reached down, and he wasn't far under the water, but like my whole arm got wet. And I remember wondering, like, how am I going to explain that my arm is soaking wet? And I was afraid I was going to have to jump into the water. But I reached down, and I grabbed a hold of him. And I was closer because of where I had driven the boat. I was closer to another landing, just a little dirt landing that was further down the shoreline. And so I decided to motor the boat and pull him over to that landing over there. So I drug him in the water over to that dirt ramp and left the boat, left him, ran back down to where our trucks were parked, got my truck, came back to where he was, backed my truck to the edge of the water, and let the tailgate down, and ended up putting him in the back of my Suburban, and I pushed the boat back out into the water to make it look like, you know, his boat was out there and he had drowned or disappeared or what. You know, I didn't give a lot of thought as to what was going to happen after that. I was just panicked as to getting out of that area and covering this up. So I realized it was probably getting too late at this point to meet up with my father-in-law, but I was still going to try. And I sped.
Chester, let me stop you for a moment. You said that you were able to load him into your Suburban.
Yes, sir.
How big was Mike?
He was a little bit bigger than me. He was a little heavier than me. We were pretty close in size, but he was a little bit bigger than me.
How much do you weigh?
Back then, probably 170, something like that.
How were you able to get a man that's 175 pounds dead weight into the back of your Suburban by yourself?
It was not easy, and it was not pretty. But I had to make it happen. I mean, I had no choice. And I can't even explain, like, how your body feels in that kind of a situation. Unless somebody's been to war or something, I don't even know how to explain, but like, you have so much adrenaline pumping through your body. It's just crazy. But, you know, it wasn't pretty. And I made a purposeful decision to never view him, to look at him. I backed the truck down, and there was an angle to the ramp. So the back of my truck was angled down toward the water, and I backed it all the way down to the edge of the water. So there was no distance involved. But yes, he was very heavy, and it was not easy to do that, but I had no choice.
You said you were concerned about meeting up with your father-in-law at that point. What happened next?
I sped back toward Tallahassee. And as I was driving there, I was realizing I'm not going to make it in time. I didn't want to call him because I didn't want to turn my phone on. I didn't want there to be any record of where my phone was at. So I left my phone off. And by the time I got back to Tallahassee, you know, I looked through the parking lot. We were going to meet at Carriage Gate parking lot. I looked through the parking lot, didn't see his vehicle there. And I decided the best thing for me to do was to go back to my house and pretend that I had overslept And then I could also make a phone call from my house to my father-in-law, which would kind of prove that I overslept and I was at my house. I wanted there to be a record of that.
And all this is with Mike in the back of your Suburban?
Yes, sir. I actually, when I was driving on Thomasville Road, I actually came up to a stoplight and there was a state trooper across from me. And I can remember just being freaked out about it. I didn't have any choice. So and that's what I decided to do. So I drove home, pulled up into my driveway, and was really, really hoping that Kathy was still asleep. I went into the house as quietly as I could. She was still asleep. I crawled back into the bed had a phone there on the floor. I can remember dialing my father-in-law and telling him, apologizing, I'm so sorry, I overslept. I didn't want to wake Kathy up, obviously, because I had what was in the driveway, but I wanted her to know I was there. So I can't remember what I said to her, but I think I halfway woke her up and said, I'm going to go out with the dogs or train dogs. I trained dogs at the time and was gone for hours at a time from the house doing stuff like that. But I don't remember exactly what I told her, but I wanted her to know that I was there, to confirm that I was there, but not wake up and start asking me any questions about what happened, why'd you ever sleep, you know, anything like that. So I did that. And then I went back out to the driveway to leave. When I went out to the driveway, my driveway was angled and I was walking behind my truck and I saw out of the back tailgate, blood was coming out of the back of my tailgate and dripping onto the driveway. And that freaked me out. So I rinsed that off and was trying to figure out. I'd been thinking on the way from Lake Seminole back to Tallahassee, what was I going to do with him? And I don't know when I decided, but, you know, ultimately I decided it had to be close and it had to be quick. And it had to be obviously a location that, you know, he wouldn't be found. And I decided on an isolated dirt road boat ramp down at Carr Lake. But I had no tools, so I had to go to a store. And I'm 90% sure the store that I ended up at was Walmart. And I bought a shovel, I bought a tarp, and I bought weights, like weights that you lift weights with, because I was thinking that I would use the weights to weigh his body down in the water or a mud hole or whatever. While I was in that store, I actually ran into a friend of ours, Mike Phillips, and I actually totally forgot about running into him or having any conversation with him until I ran into him later during the search for Mike Williams at the lake. And he said, yeah, I remember seeing you that day. You were in a panic. You were in a hurry. And he was thinking I was in a hurry to go search for Mike. But I was actually in a hurry because I was trying to bury Mike. Anyways, I bought those things at the Walmart and drove to Carr Lake down to the end of the road, turned my truck around backwards, back down to the landing. And, you know, my thinking was I was going to drag him way out into the lake. And so I got the tarp and put it on the ground behind my truck, pulled Mike out, put him on that tarp, kind of wrapped him up. And as I pulled him, instantly, I knew there was no way I was going to be able to move him any distance at all. That he was just too heavy and that wasn't going to happen. So I decided to put him down, in the lake bed itself, kind of on the edge of the lake, so that eventually when the water came back up, that area would be underwater. So I pulled him down to that area, and started digging a hole. It was hard. I was exhausted. I was getting bitten by ants all over me. I remember being scared that I was going to have to explain why I had ant bites all over me, because there was ants where I was digging. Actually, while I was doing this, I heard a vehicle coming down the road, ran back up to my truck, and a guy drove up. He was coming down there to go hunting, and he and I made small talk, chit-chat. I kind of hung out at my truck and waited for him to get several hundred yards away before I went back to digging. So eventually I got a hole big enough, and I put him there and covered him up. But now I still had a problem, because my truck had blood all in the back of it. And it was getting later and later in the day. And I knew at some point people were going to start calling me. There was a family Christmas with my wife's family up in Cairo that we were supposed to be going to that afternoon or that night. You know, I was just running out of time. And so I put the shovel in the back of the truck, and I knew I had to clean my truck up. I went two different places to clean up my truck. One of them was I went to my parents' house and tried to use a hose to clean out the truck. And it wasn't working very well. And I realized I needed to have like a pressure washer. So I ended up at Tharp Street in Old Bainbridge. There's a car wash there that had pressure washers. And I cleaned out the back as best as I could there. And after that...
Let's stop for a second.
Yes, sir.
Buried him in the car lake. At some point, do you... for lack of a better term, go about your business, go to Cairo, meet Kathy and everybody in the family.
Right. After I cleaned up, I'm sorry.
So you did you go up to Cairo, meet Kathy and family?
Yes.
Okay. At some point, were you contacted about Mike being gone, missing?
Right.
Who contacted you?
My recollection is that my dad called me and said, Mike's missing.
Whenever that happened, what'd you do? Let me back up. When was that?
I remember it being on the drive home from being up at Cairo for the Christmas party.
So was this the same Saturday?
Yes, sir.
Okay, in the evening hours?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What'd you do?
You know, when my dad called, I kind of said, well, that's Mike, because Mike was known to be late and kind of irresponsible at times, going out on hunting or fishing trips or whatever. You know, I said, I'll get back there and we'll, you know, go look for him. And so got back to town, met up with my dad, and went with him over to Lake Seminole.
That night or next day?
That immediately when I got back to town.
Okay.
There were a few people over there with boats, mainly friends, and family. And my dad and I went out on the lake and searched for Mike. He was searching and I was just lying.
My understanding, a weather front came through and it rained during that evening.
There was a storm that came through that night. I think we got off the lake before that happened, but you know, my dad wanted to look at it. I think we were the last ones on the lake. And my dad didn't want to give up. My dad loved Mike.
That would be a good time to have a party. Why don't I take 10 minutes?
The fallout from Brian Winchester's confession was severe. In 2018, Denise Williams was arrested, and the legal proceedings that followed revealed shocking details about the plot to murder Mike and her deep involvement in the crime.
The evidence was damning, and the court proceedings exposed the true nature of their relationship. Denise was found guilty of conspiracy to commit murder and several other charges, sealing her fate.
In February of 2019, Denise was sentenced to life in prison. A verdict that brought a sense of closure to some and devastation to others. The community, family, and friends were all shocked by the revelations. Many had known and trusted Denise and Brian, and the news of their betrayal sent ripples through their social circles.
One of the most heartbreaking impacts was on Mike and Denise's daughter, Ansley. She never got a chance to know her biological father, Mike. She lost Brian, the only father she ever knew, when he was sentenced to 20 years in prison for kidnapping Denise. And Brian would be the person whose damning testimony would put her mother, Denise, away for the rest of her life. And the worst part of all, Ansley will one day have to come to terms with the fact that the only family she knew were monsters.
For Cheryl Williams, Mike's mother, the verdict brought a bittersweet relief. She had fought for years, refusing to accept the initial ruling of accidental drowning. Her relentless pursuit for justice had finally paid off, and the truth was now out in the open. Cheryl reflected on the long journey and the price of uncovering the truth, feeling a mix of sorrow and satisfaction in seeing justice served. After the conviction, Cheryl Williams addressed the court and ended by saying, "For the rest of my life, as I try to sleep at night, I will see my son clinging to a tree stump in Lake Seminole in the dark, knowing that his best friend is trying to kill him. I hear his voice screaming for help. I wasn't there to help him. It will haunt me forever." In conclusion, we are in this courtroom today because of God and not Cheryl Williams. I am Mike's mother, and I did what God told me to do. My son's horrific death demands justice. With today's sentencing of Denise Merrill Williams Winchester, I believe justice will have been served. One of the most poignant aspects of this story is Cheryl Williams and her dedication to her son and her granddaughter, Ansley. For 18 years, Cheryl wrote letters to Ansley on her birthday, each one a testament to her love and hope that one day, Ansley would know the truth about her father. Cheryl poured her heart into those letters, sharing memories of Mike, expressing her longing for justice, and offering words of encouragement and love.
Cheryl's efforts to connect with Ansley so far have been in vain. Her granddaughter has not responded and refuses any interaction with Cheryl, but does continue a relationship with her mom, Denise.
As for Denise, her conviction in 2018 seemed like the end of a long, painful chapter. However, the story took another turn when Denise was granted a retrial. In 2020, a solid 20 years after Mike's murder, Mike's mom, Cheryl, once again braved the details of what happened to her son in December of 2000.
Brian Winchester remains in prison, serving time for kidnapping Denise. His confession was a pivotal moment in the case, bringing many hidden truths to light, but it also marked the beginning of his own downfall. After Denise Williams was convicted in 2018 for conspiring to murder her husband, Mike Williams, she initially received a life sentence. However, her murder conviction was overturned on appeal in 2020 due to insufficient evidence that she actively participated in the murder. Despite this, her conviction for conspiracy to commit murder remained, and she was resentenced in 2021 to 30 years in prison with time served. The court upheld her significant role in plotting Mike's death, rejecting arguments that she was a minor participant and emphasized her responsibility for allowing the crime to occur.
Today, Cheryl continues to advocate for her son, Mike Williams. Her relentless fight for justice has inspired many. I know it certainly inspired us. The journey has been long and fraught with heartache, but Cheryl continues to remain a part of her community and is loved by so many.
The community, once rocked by the shocking revelations, has slowly begun to heal. The impact of Mike's murder and the subsequent trials was emotionally exhausting on everyone involved. Yet through it all, the strength of the Williams family and their commitment to seeking justice has been a beacon of hope.
Looking back on this tragic tale, we're reminded of the resilience of the human spirit and the enduring power of love and justice. Cheryl's story is one of courage and perseverance, a testament to the lengths a mother will go through for her child and her grandchild, whom we hope one day will appreciate her efforts. Okay, well, that was a lot of information. This case was, again, I've heard about it my entire life, but diving into it for this episode was, it was just so much more than I thought.
Exactly. And to just know the deception and the lengths that they went through to hide all of this. And I just, as we know with unsolved cases that we cover, it's like, how do people live with themselves all of those years?
And to know, I think, there were options. That's what kills me. However, I will say that being from that area in the South, there is a lot of stigma, especially back then, around divorce. And especially when you're in a religious house that doesn't believe in divorce.
I know, but murder. What about the stigma around murder? I feel like people get so entwined in their feelings and emotions, and they are not thinking clearly, because just as much as there's a stigma around divorce, I think the stigma for murder would be even more.
Yeah, but divorce is saying, you know, everybody's going to find out about it. I truly think, not him, not Brian, but I truly think Denise thought nobody would know about it. I also think that she justified it and hid behind religion to, you know, pray it away. But that just shows you how, to me, evil and calculating she was. She was callous, just callous.
And if you watch his testimony, the whole testimony, it's, I mean, do you remember when he said there was never a thought to kill Kathy? Because that was the mother of his child. Mm-hmm. But Denise had no problem. And again, I want to be respectful if Ansley ever heard this or anything like that. Like, but it's the truth. Like, she didn't think of any thought of taking Ansley's father away from her.
Right. But again, I think with people like Denise, it's, they justify it. They can simply justify it away. She, but you know, you wonder, it's not like she was in this rut in her marriage and these things were going wrong. I do believe that a lot of times people feel the pressure at that age to get married. He was a perfect guy. He was somebody that who would not want to marry Mike Williams. So I think that before she even thought about it, but it really seemed out of the gate, she was not happy. And this was not, you know, he could have found somebody that would love and appreciate him. But I think that she saw in him the lifestyle that she wanted to live, the lifestyle that her parents and families and friends would be proud of.
That, and that you're supposed to live. And the truth was, she really didn't even know who she was. And as she was coming and having these different emotions and different feelings and realized she kind of went the religious path that she maybe thought was to please others and not really ever explored and grew up herself to know what she really wanted.
True, true. But if you think about that, I mean, from the beginning, she was, you know, and again, it's not like I had a drink here or there. It sounds like she really had this wild side. I don't even want to say wild. I mean, you can do what you want to do, live how you want to live. But I just think that she, yeah, I guess that's a good way to put it. She just was living an inauthentic life.
And a teenage life, because she didn't sow her wild oats before she got married. Like, yeah, it was just one thing into the other. And then she had that teenage rebellion year when she was actually married with a child. But one thing I do want to do too is the love of money, like the love of money in this, because another, if when you listen to Mike's full testimony and that other $500,000 life insurance policy, part of the timeline of when they were going to murder him was very important because Brian knew that Mike was going to cancel that additional $500,000 life insurance policy he was going to let lapse. And he even knew that Denise paid one of the premiums behind Mike's back to make sure that it was still in full force.
Well, Mike was missing at the time that he paid the premium, right?
Yes, and it might have even been a payment before that. Like he talks about, they knew they couldn't keep it up. So he might have been letting it lapse. I think he paid one before he even went missing. And then back in April, a couple months after he'd already been missing, another payment was made. Meanwhile, they had contacted the first insurance company with the two policies to start the ball rolling right away as soon as they could because...
Well, and his dad owned the company. That's what they did. They knew all about it. They knew all about insurance. They knew how to get that payday. But I do wonder from the very beginning, the first policy he sold to him, was this a thought in his head? Was he?
I would like
scheming?
To think it wasn't. I would like to think it was, because the first person you want to sell your insurance when you have that job is your best friends, and you really have that thought. But then again, that love of that money when this affair starts and he knows he's covered, and oh, it's tragic the way that you think of those things.
But you know, something we didn't touch on because we couldn't touch on everything in this case, and as we normally do, we try to streamline and say, okay, what's really pertinent and important to this, something that we did not talk a lot about or at all, was that Brian says that they had never, him and Denise, and that he was not even attracted to her, never thought about her until his wife, Kathy, had an affair. And then Kathy had an affair, which fractured Brian and hers marriage. And then he says after that his eyes opened and that he realized that, you know, Denise became flirty with him. And I, again, not to just always blame the woman, but I think Denise saw that vulnerable crack in their marriage, and that was her time to move in.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's
exactly... It makes you wonder if they were like in high school and if she was attracted to him after all that time, did she wish that she had always been with Brian?
Yeah, that's a crazy thought, all of it. But I also want to say that I don't think Brian's dad really knew what was going on. He was just trying to really help his son's friend, longtime friend, and was kind of going along, kind of used as a pawn in all of this.
Absolutely. But I think that was probably Brian. Part of what was breaking him is the fact that he knew he had used his dad. He knew of all the people that he cared about. And we've seen this. And I think it's an interesting part of human nature. People think I could never do that, but plenty of people do. Mm-hmm. And they hurt and they do horrible things to the people they love the most. And I think Brian's dad was with him through it all. And, you know, he says that he called his dad immediately when Brian was missing and that his dad was the one who went out there and said, I'm going to meet, we're going to keep looking, knowing that Brian knew the whole time what he had just done. He knew they weren't going to find Mike, but yet, and he played the game to let his dad, you know, or, you know, his dad finding the boat. It's like what he must have felt like. You just killed your best friend. He shot him in the face while he was panicking and clinging to a stump, but knowing he had to look him in the eye. There was no other way around it. He had to look at him and he had to have known. I don't know. Did he have time to reconcile that? Oh my God, my best friend is about to shoot and kill me. I just don't even think that you could probably, I hope he didn't have time to really think about that. But there was just so many of the twists and turns in this case. And the fact that for so long that Denise and Brian were sneaking around, you know, behind Kathy and behind Mike's back and really all of their friends and family. And to know how close their families were, a lot of people suffered in this. A lot of people.
Yes, but one thing that emerges is a mother's instinct. Cheryl knew that her son did not die in a boating accident. Like, she was relentless. And I think if anything else, kind of like some other stories that we've covered, you know, like Ada Martin with the Richard Martin case and other moms that just don't give up because they know, their gut knows that there's something and they're just waiting for that one break to come in. Cheryl knew her son was not in that lake.
Mm-hmm. And I love her story about that she says she was looking at that lake and she was just pining away thinking, oh my God, is my son cold? Is he out there still? Is he cold somewhere that we can't reach him? But that something whispered to her and she just felt in her soul that she knew he wasn't there.
Now that something, did she say it was God? She was a woman of faith and she knew that God was pushing her through to find the answers for this. And you talked to her and we know she didn't want to be recorded, but you talked to her. And what was that like for you hearing her explain that to you?
Well, I think, again, what you hear is just, you know, she is now, you know, she's not at the age she was when this case started, but she sounds like the same person. You know, I think a mom, she's sharp, that's for sure. She's sharp and emotional, but there's not venom there. I don't think, I mean, she wants justice, which I totally understood. But as a woman of faith, I could tell also that the venom, you know, wasn't there in terms of, I don't think she has hate in her heart. I think she thinks that they need to face justice and that it's, you know, that one day she's going to see Mike on the other side. And we talked about that too, because she mentioned her age and that she really hoped that that Nick, her son, you know, that she asked him to make sure that when she passed, that he carried that torch in case it was ever needed. And I think that that's one of the things we talked about, that nobody wants to think about their own death, but at the same time, she gets to see Mike on the other side of that.
That is true. And then Ansley, she thinks she is another true victim in all of this. And it's so hard to do a story like this, knowing that there's a young woman out there who I can't imagine being, I just want to cry because I can't imagine this woman, the only woman she's known, the only parent she's known is her mom.
Mm-hmm.
And to find out these truths, you don't want to believe them. You don't want to believe the truth. And she never got to know a grandmom that's just the only part of her son she had left.
Right. Well, you know, on the flip side of that, I think as a mom, sometimes you got to make a hard choice and you got to do what you got to do. Cheryl would not have gotten anywhere. This case would not have been solved had Cheryl not have went to the extent that she did, which was, I think it was over 2,000 letters she had written to the governor at the time. Over 2,000, she said every single day she wrote a letter. That woman was on the phone with somebody. She was writing letters. She was writing emails. As we talked about, she was holding up signs on street corners by where they lived, where they were grocery shopping, where they went to church. And in fact, I think the biggest vindication out of this also is that she was called crazy by so many that were politicians in Tallahassee, by so many agencies that she, and you know, she was in their face about it, and that their whole entire family. And in fact, there was an incident, I think, outside the church where the whole church had came out. And she was called crazy in front of everybody. I mean, they just literally thought that she was just trying to make, you know, Brian and Denise's life hell simply because they took, you know, something that to them was lemons and turned it into lemonade. They found love after the fact, when in fact Cheryl knew not happening. So I think, you know, to persevere through that, a lot of people would never have been able to withstand the pressure that she was under to go away, to just go away and die and let your son rest in peace, you know, at the bottom of the lake or eaten by alligators. But she knew. It's incredible to me.
It is.
There's so many twists and turns to this case. We do really, I would tell you, I love the book Evil at Lake Seminole. And I started reading that and I thought I knew a lot of information. There is just literally no way to go over all the information and all the steps of betrayal that are in there. So I would say absolutely that is a book that you should get. Steve Epstein's Evil at Lake Seminole. And for us, this was just a pleasure. We are so much gratitude toward Cheryl Williams and Steve for giving us information on this. And for us, this is going to officially be a break for us. We're not sure what is coming next, but we have given a lot of our love out to this podcast and to these families, and so grateful to these families for allowing us into their hearts. And so we are really going to take a break and kind of take a step back and see life is taking you on new journeys.
And you as well.
Yeah.
And we are going to see where those end up. So it is a little bit of we'll see you later, and maybe we're going to see what other cases come up and for the future in whatever ways they do.
We have been doing this podcast for almost 5 years now, and anybody who has a creative labor of love knows that it is definitely not just the two of you. Lori and I have worked together and have been on so many adventures together, but we are also friends for life and just have an incredible respect for each other. But also, we do have to thank our families who have put up with us, you know, stowing ourselves away in the closet and not letting them flush toilets and
making smoothies.
Putting the dog outside. And then all the delivery men we've cursed at for coming up to the door and ringing the doorbell while we're recording.
And hasn't it been interesting to see there have been several cases that we've worked on that were unsolved and seemed hopeless. And through these three seasons, we have seen several of them get solved. Some of them not in the way that we need them, like Ernie Ortez. There's been some, you know, there's arrests made. There's still emotional tug of wars going on in certain aspects, but still the hope. And I think every mother or father or family member that we've talked to said podcasts and telling their loved ones stories is really a lifeline that helps keep them going in their fight for justice.
Absolutely. So like I said, I think it was just an honor and a gift for all the moms that have talked to us, the moms that pray for us, the moms that we interview for their child's case and yet continue to support us on every other case and just still pour their hearts into it. So we have so much gratitude and so many good things to be grateful for on this. And we appreciate all of you for reaching out to us and supporting us all these years. And so this is not goodbye. This is see you later.
Like us on Facebook at Cold Case Playing Cards for all the latest information on this case and other cards we'll be featuring on future episodes. Healing Justice is written, produced, and hosted by Jennifer Dubisak and myself, Lori Jennings. Our executive consultant is the Cold Case Playing Cards creator, retired FDLE Special Agent Tommy Ray. If you want to help us spread the word about these victims' stories, please subscribe and leave us a positive review on your favorite podcast app and tell your friends to subscribe.
Thank you for listening and join us next time on Dealing Justice.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at chumbacasino.com. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.